So welcome, everyone, to the Spring 2017 Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series.
We do have a really great speaker tonight, a reader, but before we get started with that, I do need to remind you of a few house rules. Please don't smoke in the warehouse. Please try not to get up to go to the bathroom. It won't be that long. You can hold it, hopefully. And also, please turn off all cell phones and noise-making devices.
And one more thing, after the reading, Olivia from the FSU bookstore will be in the corner selling Robert Olin Butler's new book, Perfume River. And so to introduce him, we're going to have Zach Strait to the stage.
For the word of God is quick and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit and of the joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. Hebrews 4:12. So the work of Robert Olin Butler. How is purified in the crucible of the heart, heated in the fires of the spirit, and shaped upon the anvil of the mind, folded again and again like the pages of a book, so that it might penetrate armor and muscle and bone and enter the inner sanctum where the life of the reader dwells. My introduction to Bob's writing came during a graduate poetry workshop at Wichita State University. My professor, Albert Goldbarth, brought in two selections from Severance, read them aloud, and expressed his conviction that the book, even though it had been published as a collection of stories, should have won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. I will never forget the mixture of delight and wonder and envy I felt hearing such a beautiful story, or poem, if you will, in the voice of a decapitated chicken. Since that time, Bob and his wife, the lovely poet Kelly Butler, have blessed Allison and I again and again with their friendship. They are generous, welcoming, and kind, always ready to offer a word of encouragement or a kind smile. We have been so blessed by their time and their talents, and I want to make sure I took this opportunity to say thank you on both of our behalves. Bob is the Francis Epps Distinguished Professor at Florida State University and holds the Michael Shera Chair in Creative Writing. He has published 16 novels, 6 volumes of short stories, and a volume of lectures on the creative process, which together have been translated into 21 languages. His work has appeared in such magazines as The New Yorker, Esquire, Harper's, The Atlantic Monthly, GQ, Zoetrope, and The Paris Review. Among his many accomplishments, which include appearances in 4 annual editions of the Best American Short Stories and 8 annual editions of New Stories from the South, he was awarded the 1993 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his remarkable short story collection, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. In The Great Fires, Jack Gilbert writes, "Passion opens the castle of our spirit so that we might find the love which is a mystery hidden there." I can think of no better epigraph for Bob's work, please join me in welcoming him to the stage.
Wow, thank you, Zach. What a beautiful introduction to somebody I hardly recognize. certainly in spirit, that I hope for that. I'm glad to be here, because this was for me going to be kind of the spiritual and indeed literal end of the book tour. As many of you may know, I was not around in the fall here. did a 40-city, three-country, two-continent book tour, during which everything that bad could happen did. I had, the week before I left, I had unexpected knee surgery, and in the subsequent 2.5 weeks, walked through 17 airports, was rear-ended by a Silverado a couple of miles south of Dothan, Alabama, in my personal car, which was totaled. That was heading for the very first event. So, et cetera. But this is lovely. I'm so glad to be back here. Perfume River is, as many of you by now may know, a book about the boomer generation. And it's about our wars and our families and the way they are inextricably bound together. It's also about the secrets, kept secrets of all sorts, really, but certainly by those who go to war. And it's about the frailties of language, how what we say and think we've said may not be what we've said at all, and relationships go on forever, never corrected. I'm going to read two sequential scenes about a third of the way through the book. By the way, I'm very happy. I'm going to read things I've never read before, except when I did the audiobook. My standard stump reading, I'm still doing in my sleep, 6 weeks later. But let me give you a little background to put the scenes in context. Robert Quinlan is one of half a dozen people at the center of this book. He's 70, a Vietnam veteran. He anticipated the draft and enlisted in the Army and went to Vietnam to please his father, a proud World War II veteran. By the way, just to give you a little background on the second scene that I'll read, Robert is in Vietnam, indeed in the city of Hue, through which flows the Perfume River. And on the night of January 31st, 1968, when the North Vietnamese troops the second night of the Tet Offensive in 1968, attacked Hue. And he's in the arms of a woman he loves deeply, a Vietnamese woman, in her apartment in a side street in Hue. He runs that night to escape. Before he leaves her apartment, she gives him her father's French 32 caliber pistol. That's just a little detail you may to keep you oriented. You'll hear more implicitly about what all went on there in that scene. Darla Quinlan, Robert's wife, is 67. She's a Vietnam War protester, who met Robert at Louisiana State University after he left the Army at a protest. She meets him. And I'm going to give you now a little small snippet from earlier in the book, just to give you an initial look at both of them and sort of set the scene for you. You'll find that this book, unlike a lot of my books, is in the third person. I've been doing that more often. An omniscient narrator whose omniscience floats through many characters. And as all narrative personae are, he becomes a kind of character in the book implicitly. They are both on sabbatical this spring, and they go to what have been their separate studies ever since the house was finished. Roberts is on the third floor, where the craftsman plans called for a gentleman's billiard room. His desk faces the fireplace in the north gable with its hammered copper hood. Dormers and window seats are to his right hand and his left. His books line the room in recessed shelves. Early 20th century American history is his specialty, and he's writing a biography of a journalist, publisher, and agitator for pacifist and socialist causes, John Kenneth Turner. Tonight, he is working on a paper for a history conference. The prototype of the 20th century anti-war movement in the U.S., John Kenneth Turner, Woodrow Wilson, and the Mexican Invasion. A mouthful of a title that he sits for a time now trying to simplify. Darla's study is off the first floor hallway between the living room and the dining room. Her desk looks west through the casement windows, across the veranda, and out to the massive live oak behind their house. She teaches art theory. By certain scholarly adversaries at other schools, her research is considered to be interdisciplinary to a fault. She is known for her book, Public Monuments as Found Art, a Semiotic Revisioning. Tonight, she's trying to finish the rough draft of a paper, which indeed she will present at a semiotics conference, Dead Soldiers and Sexual Longing, the subtexts and sculptural tropes of the Daughters of the Confederacy monuments. The title seems just right to her. In the two scenes I'm going to read, Robert and Darla have recently received the news that Robert's father has fallen and broken his hip and has been taken to the hospital. Robert insists that Darla need not go to the hospital with him. His parents can be difficult. And Darla has planned a crucial visit to the Daughter of the Confederacy Monument in Monticello, Florida, over in Jefferson County. How many of you have seen that monument? Well, you may be inspired to go take a peek at it. Her paper is on deadline, and she gratefully agrees to see her father-in-law later. Darla parks in front of the 19th century brick opera house just off Monticello's traffic circle. In the center sits the Jefferson County Courthouse in the classic revival style of town's namesake. She crosses the street and turns to her left to circle the building, her eyes on the monument for the Confederate dead at the north side. From this approach, only its 8-foot base is visible beyond the waxy evergreen crown of a century-old magnolia. She has come here to fight against her mind. The semiotician part, studying signs, the signifiers and the signified, is prone to jargon-driven incomprehensibility. The art scholar part, studying created objects, can easily be stricken aesthetically blind. Both parts constantly threaten to cut her off from the fundamental human life as it is lived, first and foremost, in the moment, through the senses. Not that she doesn't love her mind. It is always quick, for instance, to see a good irony, such as this very distrust of her mind having itself begun as an idea. And it was her analytical self that challenged her to look more deeply at these monuments, issuing the challenge in this very town after she and Robert came here with friends for roadhouse food and antiques and found this relic of the old South, of the South's lost cause passion, and they laughed at its excesses, and yes, at its unintended semiotics. To give voice to this monument signified meaning both in its own era, the years, last years of the 19th century, and in this era, she needs time to stand and meditate on the thing. She is convinced that at the deepest level, its meaning is essentially a meaning of the body, of the bodies of this monument's creators, the bodies of the women, of the Ladies Memorial Association of Jefferson County, Florida, and of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. As Darla approaches, she is surprised to find her own body trilling a little at the longings signified in the part of the sculpture hidden behind the crown of the magnolia. But even with her empathy already engaged, in the next few moments, as the centerpiece of the memorial becomes visible, it is difficult for her to see the thing in terms other than those that make for easy, companionable, derisive 21st century laughter. A monumental shaft rises long and straight there, condemned in a Confederate battle flag, showing itself to her suddenly from behind the tree like a Johnny Reb dropping his pants, his man part ready for action, its condition even captioned in marble at the base, erected 1899. Erected still, 115 years later, in perpetual frustration. She draws near the monument. She grows still inside. This is not just about facile Freudianism. The frustration commemorated here is real and deep and human. It is not simply the outcome of a failed political cause, but a failed human connection. These were women trapped in a male-driven time and culture that both inflamed and suppressed their passions, intellectual and physical, inflamed and suppressed, and thus redirected and inflated them. And these were women whose men were savaged and broken and traumatized and distorted and reinvented by war. It is not lost on Darla, as she stands before the western face of the monument, that she is herself part of just such a generation of women. And without votes, without clear forms of influence, but in bodies and minds roiling with nascent independent identities and with passions that cried out for self-driven expression, these 19th century Southern women created clubs, became club women, to think and feel and organize together. History clubs and travel clubs and library clubs, improvement clubs and betterment clubs and advancement clubs, a Ladies Memorial Association, the Daughters of the Confederacy, and in this town, as in almost every other town, a literary club. Darla could see the women of the Jefferson County Literary Club convening in the parlor of one of their Carpenter Classic homes on a weekday afternoon, just the women in shirtwaists and Newport knots, sitting together, dreaming together, creating words together, writing them down. These purplish, engorged, sublimating words before which she now stood. Let this testimonial of woman's deathless fidelity to man's imperishable valor speak to the sons and daughters of this Southland for all time to come. Darla stops reading. She sits up, and it is very dark. She and Robert have been living together for less than a week. He is beside her in the bed. She struggles to disentangle her mind from a trivial dream and to animate her sleep-heavy limbs, but her hearing is fully awake, and she recognizes a snubbing of sobs in him, and then a strangled gasping, and then a wrenching in the dark, and his body moving. The sounds that woke her dissipate, and only a heavy, trembling breathing remains. She can make out Robert's body, sitting now, turned with his back to her. She lifts her hand, hesitates, moves it to him, touches his shoulder. He starts. "Sorry," she whispers. He stands abruptly, but he does not move off. He breathes heavily, and then not at all, and then a little less heavily, making an effort to control himself. He lies back down. He does not explain, not even to say he's had a bad dream. Not on this night, not ever in the decades to come, does he speak of the nightmares of their first couple of years together. She's not supposed to be party to them. But surely she knows them well enough. They are of Vietnam. They are of what he has seen, what he has done. This first time, he's been out of the army for barely 4 months. Is she moved on that night to think of his imperishable valor? No. Right and wrong are clear to her at age 23. Perhaps he stood against the horrors he faced in Vietnam. Perhaps he did not run. But for this to be achieved in service to a cause not only lost but utterly wrong, the act would be stripped of anything she'd call courage. His true valor could be found in his having marched with her against their own government, but in her growing fidelity to Robert Quinlan. When he dreams and awakens to his guilt, to his shame, how is she to help him? He has already done whatever it is he has done. She wrestles with all this, and then with a rush, she has an answer. His valor, expressed by protesting in the streets of Baton Rouge, is even greater for its having been challenged and wrecked in this unholy war. The long hairs who duck all that and hide and then prance their own righteousness are not half so brave as he. Darla blinks her way back to Monticello. The long hairs, her father's phrase. She does not want to consider her father. She concentrates on the text of the monument. Let this mute but eloquent marble testify to the enduring hardness of that living human wall of Florida soldiery that stood during 4 long years of pitiless war, a barrier between our homes and an invading foe. She is making a familiar argument to her father. You talk like Ho Chi Minh is threatening to invade Ithaca and march up our shore and into our parlor, she said. The two of them are sitting on wicker chairs on their front veranda overlooking Cayuga Lake. Resisting still, Darla turns from the Confederate monument and walks a few yards away, stops beneath a cabbage palm, its lower fronds burnt brown by last week's freeze. Her father is here, too. He's blathering about the domino theory. Why does she even bother arguing? As he goes on, she continues for now to accede to the family tradition for discussions. You at least pretend to look at each other. But she can't believe he's insulting her intelligence by spouting this nonsense, demanding she believe that when Vietnam turns communist, it will immediately topple to Chinese control, and then Cambodia will fall, and then Laos, and on and on. She's heard enough. She says, our country is totally ignorant about who we're dealing with. This much she says to his face. She is ready to make the case, but the face is so familiar. Once she voraciously studied every twitch and glint and moo of it for approval. But now Darla's first law of parental physics has prevailed. Every obsessive daughterly action to find her identity through her father will eventually result in an equal and opposite reaction. The idea of speaking to this face repulses her, and his eyes make it worse. They are the blue of a clear sky starting to go dim on a late autumn afternoon. They are her eyes. So on this day, sitting on the veranda of their upstate Queen Anne with a man who is used to being the patriarchal boss, who won't listen to reason, who spews the domino theory to justify a country gone mad, she breaks with the family tradition. She lowers her face a bit without taking her eyes off his, just to signal that what she is about to do is conscious and meaningful. And then she turns her head away. She even shifts her shoulder a little in the same direction to make both points. She is enlightening him, and she is turning her back on him. And then, as if to the forest of hemlock and sugar maple that surrounds their house, she says, "Virtually every city and town in Vietnam has a statue of a hero. They all have one thing in common. They honor Vietnamese heroes who threw the invading Chinese out of their country." It's preposterous to argue that a unified Vietnam will turn into a puppet state for the Chinese. They have 2,000 years of invasion and resistance between them. Marcus Callis, Darla's father, grew up in Hell's Kitchen. As a teenager, he helped his storefront butcher father create and market a sideline of Estonian blood sausage. As a 23-year-old, with his father's death, he took over the business. As a 30-year-old, he began making his fortune by canning meat and finding a better way to keep it moist through the heat processing. He is old country, old school, and self-made. However, with Darla's words, Marcus Callis, who finds the showing of strong feelings to be unseemly in such a man as he, even Marcus Callis cannot hide an involuntary softening and beaming in his face. In spite of his daughter's odd and insulting gesture of talking as if to the trees, she's not like all the rest of that hippie crowd. She has done her homework. She even has the right kind of backbone, stiffened by study and thought. She is old school. His political opinion does not change because of her reasoning, for he did not reason himself into the opinion. But his feeling for his daughter, in some fundamental way, does. Moments later, he layers over his newly altered feeling with the seemly reserve he is devoted to, though the feeling itself will abide till his death in a car wreck on the Taconic Parkway. What will abide in Darla, however, is an unaltered feeling about him. For in those few moments, she was looking into the trees and she did not see what was briefly evident in his face. So she returns to the shadow of a cabbage palm 4 decades later with this thought directed specifically to her father. After Vietnam was unified, it only took 3 years to prove me right. The first war they fought was in Cambodia, where they kicked out a genocidal communist regime supported by the Chinese. The second war they fought was on their own northern border with the Chinese themselves. You never understood a thing. The veranda and the house on Cayuga Lake linger in Darla's head, even as she reflexively pulls back from a road tractor, wheezing its way past in the traffic circle, its semi-trailer stacked with pine tree trunks. She cannot imagine her father's leaving her, the Queen Anne, in his will as anything but a ploy, as an effort, even from beyond the grave, to bend her to his will, his way of life, his way of thinking. The semi is gone. The smell of pine lingers. She rouses herself. She moves back to the Confederate monument. Focus, she thinks. Focus. Let the young Southron, as he gazes upon this shaft, remember how gloriously Florida's sons illustrated their sunny land on the red fields of carnage, and how woman, fair and faithful, freshens the glory of their fame. Ah, Freud. The young men gazing upon the monumental shaft of their fathers, encouraged to do so by their mothers and their grandmothers, the ladies of the club. Darla will certainly elicit laughs at the Semiotic Society of America annual meeting. What will the laughter of those mostly male semioticians signify? The following year, she might do a paper on that. But her very purpose in the paper and on this day is to find and speak the significance of this monument that brooks no laughter. Darla closes her eyes and listens to the overwrought voice of these women, their prose bepurpled with passion for their men. In the parlor that Darla imagines, where the Literary Club of Monticello crafts this prose, most of the women are Darla's age. Their men are dead. Their husbands, dead from the war, but dead even if they survived. Even if they still sleep beside these women each night, 3 decades later, for the men have grown small. The cause in them has been lost to self-pity and pettiness, to meanness and an oppression of their women, or even simply lost to a quotidian life after the war was over, a life of bricklayer or cabinet maker, mule driver or lumberjack, haberdasher or druggist or barber or teacher. And Darla asks, how did these women, fair and faithful, preserve their passion? Not just preserve, amplify. And she knows. Their passion was for the dead. And being dead, those men could never disappoint. On this night, at his insistence, Robert and Darla go to their studies and work. He being all right, his father being 89 after all, his mother bearing up just fine, Darla appreciates the chance to massage her notes from the day. They act as if this were any other evening. But when they finally enter their bed, neither of them picks up a Kindle from a nightstand, and she forgoes her iPod as well. And as soon as they are arranged in their places, side by side with a forearm length space between them in the king bed, as if on cue, they both stretch up and turn off their lamps and lie back. The room is still, but for a faint buzz from an LED electric clock, a relic of their first year in this house, preserved by Darla on her side of the bed. After a time, he says, "The children, I called them." She says, "You did? I did." "Good," he says. "It only just occurred to me. I called them," she says. "When?" "This morning, while you were at the hospital." A bead of silence. She asks, "Are you sure you're okay?" "I'm okay," he says. "If you're not, I hope you'd say so." "I would." A few beats more. Then Robert asks, "How did things go in Monticello?" "Fine." "Did you think like them, the ladies?" "Yes," he says, "the daughters." "The daughters?" "Of the Confederacy. Did you get inside their heads like you wanted?" "Yes," she says. "What was it like?" One more beat. "Passionate," she says. And now their last waking silence of the day begins. Darla does not linger with the Confederate women. Her fading consciousness somehow veers to her grandson, Jacob, who answered the phone this morning when she sought Kevin, mistakenly dialing her son's home number rather than work. She recognizes the boy's voice, though it sounds different to her. It's been nearly a year since she spoke with him. He was skiing somewhere on Christmas. He's 20, not a boy. His voice surely hasn't changed from 19. But there's something in him that's new. Maturity, maybe. "Is that you, Jake?" she says. "Grandma?" "Yes. How are you?" "I've been meaning to call Granddad." She hears him pause a beat, catching himself. "Call you both." She smiles. Jake's a good young man, not wanting to hurt her feelings. "I wish I could put him on the phone," she says, "but he's at the hospital up in Thomasville. It's Grandpa Bill. He's fallen and broken a hip." "Oh, fuck." Jake catches himself in the curse, but in doing so, utters an almost inaudible, "Oh, shit." almost inaudible. Darla smiles. He's still a boy. "Sorry, Grandma," he says. "It's okay. I'm just shocked, you know," he says. "Geez, I've been wanting to talk with him, too." "Honey, you'll have a chance. I'm sure he'll be all right. Both of them," Jake says, "you know." For a moment, she doesn't know. Then, Bill and Robert both. Jake's been thinking of them, wanting to talk with them. "While there's time, they're both fine," she says. "Fine. One has a broken hip at nearly 90. The other has turned 70. But fine, they're fine." Her mind is slowing now. Lugubrious, she'd say about her mind. The word lugubrious presents itself to her as a little surprise from someone. She thinks, "I'm falling asleep." She turns onto her side, and the movement stirs one last moment of clarity in her. The conversation with Jake was not a veer from Monticello. Robert's mortality is a matter of someone's active concern. Robert could vanish in a moment, this man who she met, who became a part of her life only because he went to war. She is sitting at a desk, rather like her desk downstairs, but it sits in the middle of a parlor in Monticello with her ladies of the literary club gathered around. She holds a quill pen over a blank sheet of paper, motionless. She can think of no words to write, though she clearly understands she must compose a tribute to her dead husband, the Southron Robert Quinlan, veteran of a lost war who is dead. For Robert as well, this silence is a waking silence. The past courses through him as spontaneously as if it were the dream imagery of incipient sleep. Leon stands in a bower of blooming flame trees on the bank of the Perfume River, waiting for him. It's June, a rare cloudless day, fiercely hot. On Leloy Street along the river, Operation Recovery has expunged the rubble of razed buildings and the bodies of the dead. The trees are splashed with flowers the color of arterial blood. She vanished with the Tet Offensive. Word of mass graves of civilians was spreading through the city, and it was understood what sort of people were slaughtered by the North in Hue. Government officials, free-thinking university teachers and students, those who could identify the embedded Viet Cong, those who had worked with, and those who had lain with the enemy Americans. Bar girls, girlfriends, lovers. Robert feared Leon was dead. When restrictions eased and he could leave the MacV compound, he went at once to the site of the tailor shop where he met her. The building survived, but the shop was closed and boarded. When the sampan community near the central market reassembled, he walked its banks over and over, searching for Leon's uncle, trying to remember the man's face, hoping he would himself be recognized by the man. And then one afternoon, an old woman stopped him outside the MacV compound and said Leon's name to him and told him a day and a time and this place, and he approaches her now. She wears a white ao dai, the tight bodiced Vietnamese silk dress with its skirt split up the sides from feet to waist, revealing black pantaloons beneath, a dress she has on special nights worn privately for him without the pantaloons, naked beneath it from waist to feet. He holds a brown paper parcel tied in hemp cord. She turns her face at the sound of his approach, comes forward. She makes no move to touch him, but explains this with her first words. "I do not touch you like I wish from people that see us." "I understand," he says. Her dark eyes focus on his, but dartingly, his right, his left, back and forth, as if she does not believe the one and seeks something in the other, then seeks it in the first again, hoping what she saw a moment ago has changed. Or has not changed. Her eyes seem anxious, only that. Their lids are rounded some by French blood. He longs to ask her to close her eyes for him to kiss her there. Surely she can read in him the feelings that produce this longing. But he senses already he will never kiss her again. "I was afraid they killed you," he says. "I hide," she says. "I have one place to hide, and then I run away." "When did you return?" "Few days before now," she says. She seems to begin to say more, a taking of a breath, a lift of her chest, but she lets it go, does not speak. He does not dare to ask the questions flaring in his head. Will she stay? Can they be together? Instead, he feels the weight in his hand. "I brought your father's pistol," he says. She takes the parcel from him, saying, "I was afraid also they killed Robert." She looks again into his eyes. She studies him closely, but with her own eyes steady now. In the center of his chest, he trembles. Standing before her gaze, given that he feared for months that she was dead, he is slow to fully understand the trembling. He takes it simply for passion. "He did help you?" she asks. Robert does not understand. She sees this. "My father," she says, lifting the parcel a little. "He saved my life," Robert says, wishing he could believe it was as simple as that. She nods. Her eyes are growing bright from nascent tears. He aches to lift a hand, to touch her face. But he knows what's next. It was always to come to this. Surely it was. But they've lost so many nights already, and those nights still before him in this country. 87 more, the count on the calendar on the wall beside his bed. Now that she is safe, now that she is here, at least some of those nights could be made to feel as if he were never going to leave her, as if she could somehow go with him. But he already understands there will be no more nights. "I am glad," she says, "my father can like you." "Could have liked," he says. The man is dead. The correction is a wistful reflex. She has always asked that he correct her English. She has always wanted to be perfect in her English for him. "My father could have liked you," she says. They wait. He feels something shift in her. "You understand," she says. "You must. You should. You will. You can't. That you must go," he says. She smiles. She has heard herself leap in her words in a way that he should not have been able to follow, but he has. They have always understood each other. And so her smile quickly fades, and the tears begin to fall. She does not wipe them away. She does not avert her gaze. "I understand," he says, and he feels his own eyes growing warm. "I cannot see this," she says, very gently. He knows that she means his tears. He looks away to the river to hide them. The seemingly incessant clouds of whey keep the water the color of cheap jade. Today, beneath an empty sky, the perfume river flows blue. He says, "You'll leave Hui?" "Yes," she says. He thinks he is in control of himself now. He looks back at her. "I love you beaucoup much forever," she says. Before they can laugh at her irony, she has used the catchphrase of the bar girls. She touches his hand, a fleeting wisp of a touch, and she turns and walks quickly away. Watching her go, he understands his earlier trembling. It was not entirely passion. The trembling would also have had him speak to Leon about the man he killed. She was the one person who might have been able to absolve him. but it's too late. And as he watches the white flutter of her ayayay, the long drape of her black hair as she leaves him, his trembling returns. Now, though, it is indeed passion. The last feeling he will ever have while his eyes are actually upon her is this ache to take her in his arms and hold her as close as he can. In the following months, his active passion for Leon slowly faded. She was gone forever, irretrievable, this woman he'd loved. Whatever was uniquely left of her within him, he could not, would not consider, dared not. That was in another country, a country at war. He worked hard to see Leon as a Vietnamese woman. He focused on the otherness of Vietnamese women, on the seemingly universal kinesthetics of them, the feeling in his chest and arms and loins for their smallness, for their softness of parts and hardness of will, for the glide of them. And so all of those qualities faded from him once he returned to the States and to the women who had shaped his desire from boyhood. These Americans were the women in their diversity, in the scale of them, who were imprinted on him. Then, in a coffee shop in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, he felt his physical desire embed itself in a long shared culture, in a shared cast of mind, in another woman's uniqueness, an American woman. He was ready for Darla. And now, in this dark room, on the night his father fell and began to hasten toward death, his remembrance of lost passion flows on in him like a river of cerulean blue and enters the sea. Darla, earlier this evening, as she emerges from her study, he stands at her door, as is their way. Whoever of them first notices that it has passed a certain hour will go to the other and wait at the door. And she emerges, as she always does, with a faintly startled look as she returns to him from the realm of her mind. And she gives him a soft sigh, as if, yes, the workday is through and there you are and I am glad. And he feels, as he sometimes does at this, a swell of tenderness. He felt it when he stood in her office door this evening, and he feels it again now, in this moment, in this bed. And Robert wishes to take Darla into his arms and hold her as close as he can. He turns onto his side. She is lying with her back to him. He pauses. Between Robert and Darla, when did sleep begin to trump desire? It has, and thoroughly enough that even as he desires her now, this is not a question he asks himself. He simply pauses from the fact of it. Perhaps it began after a certain number of years together, after they had come to a certain bone-deep familiarity. Perhaps there was a crucial time or two when he turned to her and she was sleeping, and in waking to his touch, she simply patted the beseeching hand and coiled back into unconsciousness. Or perhaps it was she who first touched him in this way. For neither of them was it understood as a general policy. But something soon shifted. Being of a certain age, perhaps they indeed preferred their sleep and respected this preference in each other. And telling themselves it was only about this or that particular night, they did not realize what else might come of it. Thank you.